this show, I just want to warn everyone, the audio was pretty awful both days, actually. So we started trying to record it on Wednesday, December 2nd, for the normal Radio Warner Wednesday show. And we had too many sort of Wi-Fi difficulties and microphone difficulties, especially over in the Budapest end where the Warner is. So we put it off to the next day, Thursday, December 3rd, and we recorded most of the show then. And the thing is, we recorded the second day was after the mass shootings in San Bernardino. The first day was before. Anyway, I think it's all the material is really good. It just might be a little bit jumpy. And a huge thanks to Yash Levine for helping to splice the many files together and, you know, make this as smooth as possible. And thank you to everyone for your patience. On to the show. Hello, I am Mark Ames, and I am not live from New York. And this is Radio Warnerd. And with me on the line from Budapest is the Warnerd himself, El Warnerd Areno, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd, a.k.a. John Dolan. John, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. El okay. Warnerd Areno, if you're not into that whole brevity thing.
Good. So how is it out there in Budapest? Or is it Pest or Pest?
It's Pest at the moment. We'll see if we're having some internet problems in the apartment, so it's a little tricky right now. I'm at a cafe. I apologize to the listeners for any background noise because of that.
No, I don't hear any background noise. At least as far as okay. I can tell. So it sounds pretty good. Hopefully this will come out all right. I think our listeners have proven to be incredibly patient and tolerant with us so far with all the audio shit that's going on. They know that that you're the wandering Warner. I mean, you guys have been moving around constantly.
It probably sounds romantic or something from a great distance, but up close it is very, very hard. And what I dream of is a little house in the woods, a 22, and a bunch of signs saying "No trespassing."
you do. You do really appreciate something like that, and just the word stability. I mean, suddenly takes yes. on. Really powerful meaning. I know that is. So are you on the Buddha side or the Pest side?
Definitely the Buddha side. It's hillier. It's the old city where, you know, the Magyar decided to build their citadel because there's a hill rising right up from the river. It's very defensible. Every time you try to climb up to the top to see Sankt Matthias Church, you realize how defensible it is. I mean, it would take a very aerobically trained army just to get to the base of the walls.
Oh, and speaking of Buddha, I should, I don't know how it sounded. I should apologize to listeners if I was a little groggy last time because I had kind of borrowed some of my mother's Vicodins, which they didn't work, but they definitely made me groggy. It's some kind of suburban San Jose thing, the Vicodins. I don't know if I told you, but her next door neighbor, whose husband is a partner at a very large law firm, used to sneak into my mother's house when she found out that my mother had a Vicodin prescription. She's got some problems with her knees. Yeah, and steal. My mother came home once and saw her coming out through her garage.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. They take it seriously, but I got to tell you, it doesn't get you high. It just gets you groggy the next day. Frustrating.
Yeah, well, but opiates are tricky in that way. You know, you can sort of have that nothing is happening feeling, but you notice it when they're gone.
Yeah. So I just want to say I'm not the only one borrowing from my mother. Also, the neighbor does, so don't blame just me. So anyway.
I remember somebody telling me that they just lock everything up from their medicine cabinet before a party because you just take it for granted that people are going to sort of sniff around the cabinet, see if there's anything worth taking there.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I just would tape mine to my body at all times. And, you know, I don't trust anybody with this stuff. All right. So moving on to wars, there's a slight war theme there. There's pain medicine and whatever, escape and other things.
The opium wars, as it were.
Ah, yes, of course, the opium wars. So, in fact, one day maybe we should even do a show on the opium wars. I mean,
should definitely do a show on the opium wars. I mean, it would straighten a lot of people out a little bit.
So moving on, the first thing we wanted to talk about before we get into sort of the bigger war story is something about Donald Trump that you noticed. It was on the Gary Butcher Facebook page, and it has to do with Trump and the Civil War. And so this guy is supposed to be our version of a fascist. You know the Civil War pretty damn well. This is something dear to you and dear to any war nerd. You know, you should be.
It's, any it's a red-blooded test. American former boy, by God.
Yeah. So what's up with Trump and the Civil War?
Trump loves real estate. So he bought a golf course in Northern Virginia that he described as a fixer-upper. I don't quite know what that means. Charlie don't golf, and I don't know anything about golfing, and I say that with pride. But he bought this golf course, and apparently, in some way, it's the one place in Northern Virginia that isn't a Civil War battlefield. But that didn't bother Trump at all. He decided to install a plaque on the golf course, which included the Trump family crest, which, you know, you sort of have to put like five question marks after that. The Trump family crest, rather? What is that? A bunch of dollar bills and a big sneer? But anyway, the plaque said, quote, "Many great American soldiers, both of the North and South, died at this spot. The casualties were so great that the water would turn red and thus became known as the River of Blood."
Oh, my God. That's the worst writing I have ever. This is like, you know, Plan 9 from outer space writing. Jesus.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. Well, that's his appeal. I mean, after a while, you start to think people like him in spite of the Plan 9 from outer space thing. And you sort of have to stop lying to yourself and say people like him because of the Plan 9 stuff. They're from Plan 9 themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, and they like someone who talks the way they do. So Civil War historians are nothing if not pedantic, and even though they're all pretty right-wing themselves, one of them, a local historian, was quoted as saying, quote, "No, no way, period. Nothing like that ever happened here, period. River of Blood, question mark? Nope, period." you can guess that he's right, because it was a time of massive casualties. The North, the casualty rate figures have been going up, and something like 300,000 just from the Union side. And they didn't tend to use River of Blood. That's a little melodramatic. Mm-hmm. They were pretty jaundiced about the whole thing. And this is Sterling, Virginia. Ball's Bluff is fairly nearby, but not that nearby. And it was just ridiculous, so ridiculous that the Civil War people had to intervene, because like Dune people, we'll be talking about Dune later. Civil War people tend to be rather serious. You know, they tend to be about 20 years older, but otherwise.
Yeah, they tend to have beards a lot too. But one thing I noticed, the one thing you said, which I thought was great, was Trump picked the only spot in all of Northern Virginia where there actually wasn't a battle and blood, you know, didn't actually fall in the Civil War, and you know, proclaimed this is where the River of Blood was or something. That's great. Maybe that's actually where the thousands of Muslims were cheering on 9/11, maybe on that same hill there or something. Maybe you just got the place wrong. I don't know.
Riverside picnic to watch the flames. But yeah, I also love his reply, because somebody pointed out to him that these historians had dared to disagree with him. And he said, "How do they know? Were they there?"
God, that's perfect. Yeah. Yeah, that is perfect. Yeah. I mean, at that point, that's pretty much it. That can be your reply to almost anything, especially to anybody who's smart, you know, and who smarts you. I mean, were you there?
Yep.
Well, no, I wasn't actually there.
Exactly.
I saw Jesus. Were you there? I was there, you know.
They hate the smart guys. Yeah. There's a lot of that in Trump's campaign. Like, finally somebody's speaking back for the angry, stupid people.
Yeah. Well, and I think what you said earlier is right, too. He is about these people who make this sort of leap of faith. And actually, the more things that he says that are completely false and this giant leap of faith, and the more that becomes this this way of mocking them, the more I think the more solid his base you know, forms, the more solid his support becomes, because these people all feel like they've been wrong about a lot of things, and they always are, and they don't like being told that. And now they have a bully standing up for them and bashing people and not listening to them and not being, you know, shouted down. He's shouting everybody else down, and they can't do anything about it. Feels good.
Yep.
Probably.
No, it's a good feeling. Absolutely. Yeah.
And especially if you don't have much else, you know, it's, before we move on, there was this interesting sort of, they're trying to find out exactly who the Trump, you know, who's Trump's base really is, who's voting for him, who wants him in. And what they found is there's a layer of wealthy older people, older white people, of course, and then not the upper class, not the 0.1%, but people who are sort of upper middle class and elderly, who feel like,
right.
I mean, they too have also, you know, as inequality accelerates, they too start getting squeezed, and their world gets squeezed, and they see this guy as somebody who pushed back. And then also, as Tom Ferguson, this guy I know through Naked Capitalism, as he pointed out, there's also a huge demographic which they haven't quite defined yet, which he basically described as lower middle class white collar. And I think that's a great way to put it, because very downwardly mobile, white collar, and elderly who are living on Social Security, which is a pittance for, you know, most people, which barely allows you to get by. I mean, again, you know, I could say my aunt, you know, very reactionary, crazy, but, you know, Chaucer expert, PhD in Chaucer, and just a rather bitter, angry woman. She's a total Trump fan. I mean, I can't even talk to
really?
Her. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's, I mean,
she also steals Vicodins from my mom's, by the way. But
that's another Trump fan and a Vicodin thief. What can you say, ladies and gentlemen? But, I mean, when you watch the news and you're angry, there's a lot of stuff that you'd like to see solved with a nuclear weapon, I think. And I've known a lot of people like that. And
yes.
Trump talks that way. I mean, just today he said on apparently some Fox show, he was asked about how exactly he would deal with Islamic State. And his solution was to bomb the hell out of them. And he said the U.S. is fighting a very politically correct war, which is sort of the definition of effective counterinsurgency, a politically correct war.
Exactly.
Actually, it's very hard to make people understand that.
Yeah.
They want Hiroshima. So what he said is, you know, when you get these terrorists, you have to take out their families. And there's an echo of an ancient strategy, an obvious strategy there, which is an answer to the question, why didn't guerrilla war dominate, you know, two centuries ago, three centuries ago? And that's because until recently, it was perfectly practical to wipe out an entire community if they staged a few sneak attacks. For various reasons, it's not really practical to do that anymore, but there's a lot of nostalgia for that solution. So, you know, somebody gives you trouble, you kill them all. But part of the problem with Trump and his people is that they really can't imagine any place other than the U.S., and they don't quite understand what family means. I mean, what family means in a place on the Arabian Peninsula is vastly different from what family means in the U.S. It's not just some people you see at Thanksgiving and squabble with and slam the door and say, oh, thank God they're gone. It's a lot more important than that and a lot bigger than that. And something like, I mean, well, that's true in the U.S. too. I mean, Trump's people are part of a tribe. They just don't see themselves that way.
Yeah, because they're the dominant larger tribe, I guess.
The dominant tribe never sees tribe.
But then that's a great point about family, though, in that part of the world and a lot of parts of the world that aren't America. It goes to cousins and area and, you know, it's just different than ours. It's pretty stupid.
Yeah.
Woofing, though, is an old tradition, too, isn't it? Since genocide went out, woofing is a big thing. Like, we'll turn Vietnam into a parking lot or bomb it back to the Stone Age and so
bomb
on.
Bomb it back to the Stone Age and all that. Yeah. It's very satisfying, but it's not very smart. And it's basically, it's a woofing strategy. And that may be all people want. If you listen carefully to what Trump's people object to about Obama, it's what Obama actually does well. He's a very good master of assassins.
Mm-hmm.
He may not be very good for the American domestic policy. He's kind of let everybody down there in a lot of ways. But he's a very good master of assassins because he smiles well and he talks in a politic manner. And that's part of what passes for the theory of counterinsurgency at the moment. I mean, it's not a very good theory, but it's a better one than when they're blasting. I mean, and that leads to the next thing we're going to talk about, which is the mercenary phenomenon.
Touchy there. So yeah, we're going to talk about mercenaries now. Segue in, good segue, by the way. Because of the story that just came out recently, I mean, it's just the latest in a sort of the string of mercenary stories where the United Arab Emirates is sending Blackwater-trained Latin American death squad mercenaries into Yemen to fight alongside or to be the ground troops for them and the Saudis, I guess. Is that right?
That's right. This was a New York Times story. We got to give them credit. It was a good story. These are mainly veterans of the Colombian Army and probably the associated paramilitary right-wing groups that helped the Colombian Army against FARC, the very successful left-wing insurgency in Colombia. They have a lot of combat experience. They have very few scruples. They need money. And that fit perfectly with the United Emirates, which has a lot of money, no tradition of military service, and a lot of engagements on the Arabian Peninsula. I mean, the UAE is kind of like Kuwait, and my wife and I worked in Kuwait, or rather, she worked there. I was fired on my first day. But our job there was supposed to be training Kuwaiti army officers, and you get a really strong sense of the lack of military tradition, to put it mildly, in places like that. I mean, Kuwait is relatively populous for a Gulf Emirate type country. A third of the population is actual Kuwaitis, people who are Kuwaiti citizens. But in the Emirates, it's something like 15% who are citizens. And the rest, you can think of them all as mercenaries. You know, janitors are mercenaries. The teachers, like us, are mercenaries.
Right.
And the military is mercenary, too. I mean, everybody's there for the money, not because they like the place. If you get in a taxi in Kuwait, you know, the guy will be from Kerala, usually, or Pakistan or Bangladesh, and he'll usually speak English, and he'll usually ask you, how do you like Kuwait? And you make some noncommittal answer and say, how do you like Kuwait? And he said, I like the money. So everybody there is a mercenary. Mm-hmm. So naturally, the army's going to be mercenary, too. I mean, we knew, or rather Catherine knew, and I got to hear about Kuwaiti military officers. And my two favorites were these two very smart, very cynical guys. And their main interest was factories in Guangdong in southern China, because they both had factories in Guangdong. And their main interest was talking about, in good English apparently, about how their factories were doing. But the idea that they would ever have to fight did not enter their thinking very much. I mean, when it came to real strategic considerations, Catherine said they were very simple. They said, Kuwait used to belong to the British, now it belongs to the Americans. And they shrugged. Mm. And then they got back to talking about the factories. Mm. So this is not a military tradition we're dealing with. Nobody is going to die for – no Kuwaiti is going to die for Kuwait. No citizen of the Emirates is going to die for the Emirates.
Well, for that matter, so we were Kuwait's we were Kuwait's mercenary army in 1991, right? So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a mercenary operation. It's like, hey, we've bought a lot of your stuff, and now you need to help us out. Mm-hmm. Because when Saudi or Kuwait buy weapons – it's not so much that they're buying weapons to use them as weapons. It's that you have to remember the defense industry is one of the few remaining strongholds of American industry, one mm-hmm. of the few things that we still lead the world in. And they buy all this stuff. I mean, in fact, Saudi, for example, recently did a $60 billion deal with the U.S. to buy AH-64 attack helicopters, I think 75 F-15s, a lot of Black Hawk utility helicopters and Little Bird Scout helicopters. Mm-hmm. $60 billion, that's a lot of money for American industry. And really, when you move out of defense and software, there isn't any American industry anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's very important.
Guangdong,
so,
most of it. I mean,
it all went to Guangdong, exactly. Yeah. So they say, hey, we bought all this stuff from you. Now we need payment. So, yeah. But there are times when you want to do some low-level stuff that isn't severe enough to call in the American favor, the American IOU. And that's what's happening in Yemen. I mean, the UAE has joined its Saudi big brother trying to smash the Shia Houthi in Yemen, because the Houthi are better fighters than the Sunni of Yemen. They're the people right south of Najran, where I used to work in Saudi Arabia. And in fact, they've supposedly taken a city in Saudi Arabia just west of Najran, Al Rabwa. And in return, the Saudis have been bombing the hell out of them with very little worry about civilian casualties. The more collateral damage, the better, is the Saudi view. That
it's kind of incredible that they've, I mean, it's almost like a good thing that, that so much attention is focused on Syria.
The hatred for Shia among the Saudis. So this is too small a conflict, too low level, to call in the U.S. The U.S. has only a marginal interest in Yemen. So you have to hire somebody else. And the cheapest mercenaries who have real combat ability are going to be from Latin America. There are five big mercenary companies in the world, and one of their biggest recruiting sources is Latin American mercenaries, who are pretty good, at least some of them, and work a lot cheaper. I mean, some of them will work for $2,000 a month, whereas a Blackwater mercenary from the U.S. was making almost $1,000 a day. There's this company called Defion, which specializes in Latin American mercenaries. So it's very much like the way Catherine and I were hired to teach ESL in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. You know, they're labor contractors sort of on the waterfront without the fisticuffs. And they hire people in their field, whether ESL teachers or mercenary soldiers. They pay them a fraction of what the company gets, because the company just says, the government says to the company, whether it's the Saudi government or the UAE government, here, we'll give you a contract to sell us 1,000 soldiers at $7,000 a month. And they say, great. And they offer the potential soldiers $2,000 a month, and they pocket the rest.
Right.
That's how it works.
Right.
Simple labor contracting. But it's a lot better than these guys can make in Colombia. They make maybe $400 a month as Colombian soldiers. They can make at least $2,000. And supposedly, according to the New York Times, the ones who are being sent to a hot war in Yemen, it's a very hot war. The Houthi can fight. You have a real chance of dying. They make an extra $1,000 per week, which to a Colombian soldier is a whole lot of money.
Hardship pay.
Yeah. 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 So it makes sense. And this is, as the world gets privatized and as free enterprise becomes the only socially acceptable model for arranging a society, mercenaries are going to become much more the norm. I mean, you could argue that the U.S. armed forces have gone from an idealistic citizen service thing to something like a mercenary service. The U.S. is now an all-volunteer force, and as a lot of studies have shown, most of the people in the U.S. military, not most, but an awful lot of the people in the core of the U.S. military are second or third generation military. So this has become kind of a family occupation, a family tradition. And that is close to being something like a mercenary force. And that doesn't imply they don't love the U.S. and that they're not patriotic and all that, but it does mean that's how you make your living as soldiers.
Interesting. So what is the definition, I guess, of a mercenary today?
It depends on whether you're using it in the pejorative sense or not. And I don't care. You can use it either way if you want.
Right, because there's a lot of moral, you know, baggage that goes with the term mercenary.
Absolutely. And there probably deserves to be, because war is an ugly thing. And those who pursued it by choice without having a stake, you know, without trying to defend their homeland or anything like that, were pretty nasty people as a rule. They tended to be single men or men with female companions that they cared very little about, who were in it for the money. I mean, of course, a lot of other armies have been in it for the money too. There's just this idea we have that real soldiers only do it when something they care about is at stake. Mercenaries do it just for the fun or the pillage. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people did it for the fun and mm-hmm. the pillage. It's more normal than we think. Right now, there's, you know, a lot of economies are declining, and not by accident. In the U.S., for example, if you were an ex-forces soldier circa 2005, what were you going to do? I mean, you could try to work construction or something, and you'd make very little, and you'd break your back. Or mm-hmm. you could work for Blackwater, make $1,000 a day, shooting people in Iraq. And that was an easy decision. You know, around 2007, especially when the economy crashed, the money kept coming in mm-hmm. from Blackwater. The only thing that even stopped Blackwater for a moment was in 2007 when they were finally caught for something, the Nisour Square shootings right. in Baghdad. That was a middle-class or upper-class part of Baghdad.
Uh-huh.
So people actually cared what they did there. And what they did, basically, was after getting hung up in a traffic jam, their convoy just started blasting everything that moved. Disgusting stuff. Just yeah. disgusting. They killed at least 17 people.
Wow.
And the State Department tried to defend them. The government tried to defend them. And finally, four of their guys were convicted. One of them got life. Three of them got 30 years. But of course, Eric Prince, the guy who started Blackwater and made all the billions out of it, and I mean billions, mm-hmm. Is free and happy and was never even close to being convicted of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice if well, anyway, it would be nice.
Yes, I know. That's another thing about Obama. I never brought any of these people to account at all.
Yeah.
In fact, basically covered for them.
Never.
Yeah, that's so that's what the mercenaries are. And are, I guess the question now so far is how is the war going in Yemen for the Saudis and their allies? And I mean, we're involved in that as well in some way. I'm sure we're backing, at the very least, we're backing the Saudis.
Oh, yeah. We always back the Saudis. Mm-hmm. It's pretty gross. But I think less intensely in this war than in others. We're probably feeding them satellite data and all that. Mm-hmm. But I think they have access to anything they want to buy from the U.S. anyway. Basically, the war in Yemen is kind of a stalemate. I mean, the Houthi have conquered or reconquered most of their traditional territory, which is Western Yemen on the Red Sea, what used to be called North Yemen. If you mm-hmm. remember, if you're old like me, there was a time when there was North Yemen and South Yemen.
And it never made sense because one was on the left and one was on the right. It was like, what the heck?
Yeah. North Yemen is basically Shia. South Yemen is mostly Sunni, mm-hmm. And they hate each other. And the North Yemen extended far north into what is now Saudi Arabia, into the part of Saudi Arabia where I used to live, Najran and Jizan on the Red Sea, which is why, as I've written about before, there were weird moments in Najran, such as Ashura, the greatest Shia holiday of the year, where, you know, I went to work and suddenly noticed that my classes were empty and nobody would tell me why, because Saudi Arabia refuses to recognize that some of its citizens are Shia. They are not considered real people, which is what the war is about. Mm-hmm. So the Shia have reoccupied northwestern Yemen. The Sunni, with a great deal of Saudi bombing help, have taken back provinces in the south.
Okay.
And the rest is just...
What's the city they bombed to rubble? I mean, was it Sana'a or what, the capital? Or which is the one? I mean, I've seen some photos. They're just appalling. It looks like, you know, it looks like basically Syria.
Yeah, I think it's Sa'da in the province just south of Najran, because that's a purely Shia city. Mm-hmm. So they blasted it to rubble. Mm-hmm. Sana'a is a little trickier. It's the official capital.
So they haven't totally blasted.
But yeah, it's been indiscriminate bombing. Not as far as I know, but nobody really cares, let's face it. And the Saudi Air Force isn't really held to any standards at all. So they're killing at will. One of the interesting things about this question about mercenaries is that often countries which have no tradition of really competent soldiers from their own citizens will have competent air forces staffed by their own citizens, because it's sort of like the tradition of having cavalry officers from the aristocracy. You know, a fighter pilot is something like a cavalry officer in 21st century
That's
terms.
A great point.
He and it's almost always he is a warrior in a way that you can boast about, and he makes dozens of times what a soldier makes, and he has all these skills that are highly valued. So that, for example, in the Falklands War, the Argentine Air Force performed really well to the point that it scared the hell out of the British forces. The Argentine Army was just out of its depth. Donnie, you're out of your depth. So the Saudi Air Force is pretty competent, and it's what it's doing competently is...
Okay, so we're back to recording the Warner. We've had some technical difficulties, and in the meantime... since we're on, you know, two different hemispheres here. In the meantime, of course, there was this mass shooting in San Bernardino in the Inland Empire in Southern California. And it's turned out that, I mean, you know, the problem with talking about these rampage shootings or mass shootings or any of these things too early is, you know, the initial information is often wrong. You know, what you wind up learning later, but this is what I know, especially from doing the Going Postal book, you always learn so much more later on, and it often is quite a different picture, whether it's a school shooting, a workplace shooting. What this one is looking to be, and it's still coming out, and our discourse is so highly politicized that, you know, it's hard to even sort of, you know, sift through all of this, but it appears to be some kind of maybe a hybrid, a mixture of a disgruntled worker workplace shooting plus like a jihadi, you know, massacre, terrorism kind of thing. So I don't know. Have you, that's the latest that I have seen. And again, we'll find out more there. You know, there's some reports that this guy and his wife, so he was a worker apparently with the San Bernardino County and the some kind of a health inspector, environment inspector, and his wife he met on an online Sunni marriage dating site, and she's Pakistani apparently, and
it's Pakistani descent also, right?
He's also Pakistani descent. Okay,
I haven't been online because we're having problems in Budapest with our internet connection, but what I read is that it was born in America but Pakistani descent. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, it's hard to talk about this right now because one of the reasons it's hard is that a lot of really evil people are going to be talking about this to score points in the domestic American political world.
Exactly.
We have no interest in that at all. No. Let's just be clear about that.
Yeah, I know. Pamela Geller, I mean, what's so really horrible to me is that Pamela Geller, as far as I could tell, and you know, she's like one of the worst, like hagfish, you know, in this country, seemed to be the one pushing out the actual true name and identity of this person first, as far as I could, at least from Twitter. And I just immediately thought, well, whatever she says has to be absolutely wrong. And when she turned out to be, at least on that particular score, right? I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's all very toxic now. There is some precedent for, I mean, look, a disgruntled worker who is pushed to the point of sort of massacre, suicide, you know, is basically expressing himself or herself in a way that's, I don't know, become popular in our time, or it's
when somebody goes crazy, they go crazy in the way the culture has decreed. And if this guy is from an Islamic background, he's going to express it in Islamic terms. I had a bipolar Uncle Fred, who thought he was two Catholic saints at once at one point. He used to answer the phone, "Hello, Jude Anthony residents," because he thought he was both St. Jude and St. Anthony.
Wow.
So it always comes out of whatever your culture offers. And if you're in a murderous mood, there will be resources within culture for that.
Yeah, and I recall in France, something like about sometime this year, earlier this year, there was a sort of workplace killing of some sort, where I think a worker killed his boss, but he was Muslim and he beheaded his boss.
Right.
You know, and so people at first said, well, this is terrorism. Well, it had a real workplace element to it. I think he was being bullied. I can't remember. There was downsizing. I mean, I'd have to go back and look. All this is just, it's all this information is so new and fresh and coming out. And like you said, yeah. The last thing we want to do is, you know, align in any way with these fucking Ted Cruz's. And
but, you know, the audience does seem real in this case, and I say that very reluctantly. But it does seem to be there, along with some sort of workplace thing. This happened at a workplace celebration of some kind, right?
Christmas.
Christmas. That's, yeah, okay. That's,
I mean, I hate to say this, but
that
would send
a charged term.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, you know, Christmas celebrations would send a lot of people over the final edge.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it was because it was a Christian hall. Who am I to say? We're still going to find out, but I think it was, I could imagine in San Bernardino, a lot of things that would drive somebody.
Yeah.
You know,
that's pretty much all we can do right now. We can imagine a lot of scenarios that might end up fitting for this. I mean, I know somebody from San Bernardino and he always described it as a pretty rough place. I mean, there may have been some rather charged conversation at this celebration. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'll bet you there was something. If it has a workplace element, it would be also something that had built up over time. And the other thing, you know, for some background is, I mean, San Bernardino, the city, declared bankruptcy. It was one of those cities that was utterly destroyed. Central California. You know, all the way down to central Southern California was, you know, ground zero for the subprime crash.
Right.
Yasha lived in San Bernardino County, right in Victorville.
And I saw some of the names. The papers have names like Inland Empire. And
yes.
It really took me back to Victorville.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a pretty grim place. And so San Bernardino City declared bankruptcy, but a kind of half-assed bankruptcy because they didn't want it going all the way up to the Supreme Court. It's questionable whether it's legal. What it essentially allowed them to do was enact, you know, hire one of those management consulting firms and then enact a program of, you know, massive fee hikes, privatization. They privatized the fire department. They privatized the trash, you know, pickup, sewers. I mean, you know, they're doing basically like a Greece austerity program in San Bernardino City. Now the meeting and this guy himself, the shooter, and the Christmas party were for San Bernardino County officials, not city.
Right.
So, but you know, it is important to kind of keep that in the background. It's a mean place and a very gun friendly place. And it does also have, an old, well-known, a big Mormon population. That was one of their early settlements and a lot of neo-Nazis. And it's just a pretty charged up, mean place. I don't really know what else we could say about it besides that until we know more.
No. Well, it's one of the angles that I haven't seen before. But I mean, Mark, this is your field, so you know better than I haven't seen a mass rampage like this by a couple before.
No,
has that happened?
No, and that's why I was going to say. So when the details were coming out, I mean, if it was one person, to me, it would say, okay, it was almost for sure. A disgruntled worker, workplace rape, murder, you know, when they were saying two and three at first, I thought, well, they say that a lot in shooting. Sandy Hook, there was a, you know, and it would
always, there's always a phantom accomplice, and it usually turns out not to be there.
Yeah. Exactly. And then some conspiracy theorists later pick it up and say, you know, this was a bomb as planned to take away our guns, you know? And in this case, it turned out that there really were two, people and maybe a third. I guess they're still trying to figure that out. And I mean, I even sort of said this on Twitter yesterday. I mean, if it was more than one person, this would not be a standard rage murder at all. I mean,
those people seem to be remarkably alone for one thing.
Yes, I mean, yeah, often that's one of the things that drives them to it. And but the funny thing is, a lot of them tend to have. I mean, there are a lot of married men, for example, who have been rampage murders in their workplace and in post offices and so on. They just, you know, people don't necessarily, especially when they're sliding down, they don't necessarily share their pain with the person next to them, and especially in America where, you know, everybody's supposed to be happy and doing great and don't really talk about it. It's not like Russia where if you're failing and you're miserable and you're a loser, like that's all people want to hear from you. And it's so, kind of made me feel good there. So, segueing back from that to mercenaries, if this is something that was in any way planned, one thing, a report that was sent to me by a friend, I don't know if this is true again or if this is the right wing stuff, but apparently not only were they wearing some kind of like body armor and camouflage and all this stuff, but they wore GoPro cams. I don't know if this is true. But that would like add a whole new like an element. Uh-huh. Now, the thing is, I could have seen, like, for example, Dylan, so Klebold and Harris, you know, the Columbine shooters, if there were GoPro cams where, you know, you wear on your head, they would have definitely worn them because they were filming themselves babbling and yammering for, you know, months before they carried out the actual massacre. But it would
they
be,
they just didn't have the technology. Unfortunately.
No, they didn't. So getting back to mercenaries. I mean, we were talking about how mercenaries in the Air Force. We were talking about how Air Force was sort of the cavalry aristocrats of today. I mean, do you want to close that one up?
We were talking about the UAE and the situation in Yemen, and so the UAE can use its own Air Force, which is probably reasonably effective. I don't think you can be a completely incompetent fighter pilot, or you die. Or you'd run for president in 2008, Grimshaw. they don't have ground forces. And if it was an existential threat, as you know, the Israelis are always invoking, such as happened to Kuwait in 1991, you could call in your debts to the Americans. We were talking about those debts, defense budgets, et cetera. But the Yemen intervention is war of choice for the UAE and basically something the Saudis got them into, not the Americans. And so they can't really call on American soldiers to get them out of it. So they have to go hiring mercenaries, and the ones they're using at the moment seem to be Colombian. I mean, veterans of a really dirty, long, vicious war in Colombia. Those people got drawn in by promises that they'd be dealing with domestic unrest, which is really a pretty low-risk thing. I mean, you're shooting people who are throwing rocks, basically, and they're much more likely to die than you are. But now they're in a war with people who shoot back, because the Houthis shoot back pretty darn well. And for that reason, it's very simple. You offer them more money, and that's why they're getting that extra $1,000 a week that we talked about. Which for a Colombian soldier is an awful lot of money. It's probably a matter of real indifference to somebody who's coming out of the dirty wars in Colombia, who's right or wrong in Yemen, if you can even talk in those terms. If this works, it might prove to be an effective way for the UAE. But there's, you know, having lived in Kuwait, Saudi is a different thing. There are plenty of Saudis in Saudi. But in places like the UAE, I mean, some of these places have only like 11 or 12% citizens.
Qatar and these other
places. So you can't help thinking, and this was something I thought a lot when I was in Kuwait, what's stopping us taking over? I mean, basically the answer to that is the U.S. Army and Air Force, stupid. But failing that, you know, it's the kind of place where you can easily imagine the mercenaries taking over. And basically everybody there is a mercenary. The custodians are mercenaries. The teachers are mercenaries. We're all mercenaries. And in Kuwait, I remember a particularly weird moment. The working class of Kuwait, almost the surf class, you could say, are Carolans. And I've known a few Carolans, and I tend to like them.
Wait, what are Carolans?
Oh, they're people from the southwestern part of India.
Oh, okay.
Near Goa, that part
right,
of India,
okay.
basically. although Go is a different thing, obviously, right. but the area around Goa, basically. And
are they Christian or Hindu?
They're all mixed up. Yeah. The ones I knew were Muslim, but that was okay. Because they were in Saudi. They're also Christian Goans and around Christian Carolines around Goa, mostly where the Portuguese were.
Right.
And there are Hindu Carolines also.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's a big birth rate crisis in the Carolin press at the moment because supposedly Muslims are having more kids, and there's this horror that Hinduism might be the minority religion in Kerala, which horrifies a lot of people with sectarian anxieties. So anyway, they're all mixed up, but it's kind of a nice place. Or at any rate, all I can say is the people from there that I've known, I really liked. And I remember I was walking across one of the many dust fields in Kuwait. And in Kuwait, there's a real difference between the equestrian and pedestrian classes. I mean, if you're a Kuwaiti citizen, you drive a big SUV and you don't let anybody get in your way. And if you're somebody like us, you walk across the dust fields. And I was walking across the dust fields in the hot afternoon, and I saw these Carolin laborers getting off of one of the big blue buses. And they were exhausted. It was a horrible day. It's always a horrible day.
Hot and dusty.
Hot and the glare and the dust. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not to be believed. As I said in an article once, it looks like the whole planet will look in 1,000 years or so after we've finished messing it up for good. And these guys got off the bus and they sort of looked at me. And the first look is, old white man, nothing to do with us. But you're not the enemy either. You're definitely not the enemy in Kuwait because the enemy is the Kuwaitis.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of noticed that I was walking through this dust field, and they looked at me a little differently, like, huh, you walk too?
And, solidarity.
Yeah. And it was kind of a cool feeling, although I know it didn't mean anything, but it was kind of a cool feeling. And what it did make me realize is there are so many of us in Kuwait. We, the foreigners who are there only for the money, are 2/3 of the population. In places like Qatar, it's a much higher percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very tempting to think, if you start bringing in mercenaries in large numbers, man, I mean, to a very rich country with very weak people, I don't know. Yeah, it's a dream anyway. I can dream, okay?
Well, I mean, this could lead into our talk about Dune.
Yeah.
No, that is interesting. But, you know, who keeps it back? I mean, it's the oil companies that...
Yeah, the oil companies. And,
they like the current arrangement as it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the oil companies, if they'd wanted, they probably could have made the oil areas of the Middle East the 51st state. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think anything could have stopped that. But I think in some way that I don't fully understand myself, because money is not something I understand very well at micro or macro levels, they prefer having these corrupt governments in place over there. It seems to serve their interests in a lot of ways. Oh, they would not let that happen.
Well, it does seem. I mean, it serves their interest because they do have a bigger political view of things. I mean, you know, there's that amazing Trump line. It was like, the person was like, "Yeah, this makes so much sense in a right wing way," where he tweeted out, "I can't believe we left Iraq without the oil." And I mean, it's one of those brilliant, dumb, and brilliant lines imaginable. And I think it's shit like that connects directly with so many people. Like, yes, yeah. I've been thinking that for the last, you know, people on the right, I mean, especially, I've been thinking that for the last 10 years. They didn't want to say it. They want to somehow blame Obama for this and Bush for that. But ultimately, it's like, didn't we go in to take the oil and we left without it? Like, what the fuck else?
Yeah.
But the oil companies... You know, they would rather have proxies, essentially proxies, and they've sort of viewed the ups and downs of direct colonialism, indirect colonialism, and then deals with sheikhs. And this seems to be the best arrangement for them thus far. And they'll work, you know, when this becomes a giant shit show at some point, you know, they'll work out some other arrangement. But, you know, for one thing, I mean, it's the locals have a stake A local powerful class has a stake in keeping the same order of things as it is right now. That's kind of like why when Russia first privatized in the early 90s and it was chaos, I mean, we helped create an oligarchy specifically so that there'd be a class of people in whom it would be in their interest to defend the current order with everything they had, rather than just people kind of like stealing stuff and fleeing all the time. So I think they're willing to trade off some of the profit for that. And the oil companies have a lot of ways to make profits beyond just the marketing, the shipping, the distribution, so on. There's also all the financialization of oil. I mean, you can bet on the rise and the fall of oil, and you can manipulate that.
You can bet on the rise and fall of the product that you're doling out.
Exactly.
That's a price game.
Exactly. And they do a lot of that's why we see oil, go up to 160 a barrel, down to 40. It's not they completely control that, but they definitely make a ton of money off that. The Cokes make a ton of money off that. They don't really own much in terms of actual oil fields. They own, I can't remember how many times around the Earth's worth of oil pipelines, and they're probably the number one oil and gas financial derivatives traders or bettors, basically.
Yeah.
So
that actually does lead into Dune rather nicely, he said suavely, because Dune. Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming everybody listening to this has read Dune or at least seen the movie.
If you're a war nerd of some kind,
the overlap has to be huge.
Yeah,
and Dune is about a planet which is completely waterless desert, and also happens to have the one thing that the whole universe needs in order to run, and especially the one thing that it needs to get transport. I mean, the planet, the transport they're talking about in the novel is interstellar, but the product spice, as in the spice must flow, is what you need in order to make a guild navigator, these sort of bizarre mutated humans who can somehow pilot a ship through interstellar space. Dune is one of the so-called soft science fiction novels. That is, it doesn't go into detail about how these ships function. But, why should it? If you were writing about the oil wars in the Middle East, you wouldn't necessarily spend the first 100 pages talking about how internal combustion engines work. Yeah. And what people call hard science fiction is the equivalent of doing that. Like, the Heinlein stuff, which is, kid stuff. But Dune is something else. I mean, there are two ways to talk about it, like where it came from and what it got right and wrong.
First of all, we should mention it is the 50th anniversary this year.
Right, that's why we're talking about that. Yeah, sorry, I forgot the main thing.
That's what I'm here for, John.
Yeah, Dune was written in 1965, and it's worth, I mean, I'm an old guy. I'm old enough. I was a kid in 1965, but I was there. And if you're half my age, which a lot of you probably are, it's going to be hard to imagine 1965. I mean, the Dune is a novel of jihad, and jihad did not exist as a term in most people's vocabulary in 1965. Islamism, that whole thing, it was barely on the horizon. The CIA just that year used Islamist militias to kill hundreds of thousands of Chinese and leftists in Indonesia, but that was new. They were just beginning to discover the possibilities, or what they thought were the possibilities. Mm-hmm. So all this was new. I mean, if imagine the literary world of 1965. This is a world where people like Norman Mailer and John Updike are taken seriously as writers, and their writing is considered to be true literature, and the work that Dune came out of, the Bay Area Science Fiction Group, was treated with absolute contempt. These are people like Philip K. Dick, who's revered quite properly today, but at the time was making a few hundred dollars a novel.
And they called him, when he started to get taken more seriously, he was the best compliment they could give is he was a poor man's Thomas Pynchon. That pissed me. I want to find whoever wrote that and just punch him in the fucking face.
Yeah,
Pynchon is unreadable garbage, seminar garbage.
Pynchon is crap. Yeah. Not all the high literature writers of the 60s were crap. I mean, Philip Roth is a really, really good writer. Yeah. But a lot of them were pretty lousy. I mean, John Updike is just a lousy writer. He's boring as hell.
Yes.
I mean, Norman Mailer is a buffoon.
Yes.
These guys were worthless. But the people on the Bay Area, I mean, in this one little clot of underpaid, sneered at, formulaic science fiction writers, you've got Philip K. Dick, Ursula Le Guin, Frank Herbert, and my personal favorite at the moment, Jack Vance.
And we should add, right outside that circle, but very close to it, Hunter Thompson just starting on Hell's Angels.
Yep. They were part of that wave he described, rising from the Bay Area and eventually crashing against the shores of Las Vegas and seeding, sadly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but for a while there was this amazing, unrecognized, unnoticed collection of talent writing science fiction. And Dune was a product of that. I mean, it became more popular than other science fiction novels, much more so, to the point that Frank Herbert made a total of $20,000 out of the novel, which was considered big, big money in the science fiction world.
Wow.
There are a lot of strange shocks when you reread Dune, which I've been doing just recently. We got a 50th anniversary copy in the English language bookstore here in Budapest. And it's always painful that blurb you mentioned about poor man's pension. It's always painful to read those blurbs for that you're really interested in. Like on the back of this copy of Dune, it says, "Before The Matrix, before Star Wars, before Ender's Game and Neuromancer, there was Dune, the greatest science fiction novel ever written," which is doubtful too. But it has very little to do with those things, except in one way. I mean, one reason science fiction novels got dismissed in that world of John Updike and Norman Mailer is that they're committed to the idea of possibility. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that I was really struck by rereading Dune just now, the importance of taking tests. I mean, I'm assuming more people have seen the movie than read the book, and you remember that amazing scene where the Bene Gesserit mother holds that needle to his throat, the Gom Jabbar. And this was something massively important in Bay Area culture, as I remember, because I was a kid in that culture. And what I remember above all was the test that you took at around age 7 or 8 at teachers' recommendations to see if you would be in the MGM program, commonly known as the gifted program. Mm-hmm. It never amounted to much if you were. You just got invited on field trips because they got extra money for you. And this was a subject of much bitterness in my family. Supposedly that was why they kept me in the public school rather than Catholic school. Whereas the truth was we didn't have any money for me to go to Catholic school. But anyway, and nothing ever came of that program. But passing that test was a huge, huge thing to kids, to the point that I knew somebody named Terry Allen who got sort of warped for life because he took the test and failed. Mm-hmm. And he kept saying, they gave that to Peter Allen instead of me because of some problem about the name. Mm-hmm. That was how messed up he was about that test. And so the first thing you read in Dune, right on page 7 that I'm looking at right now, is Paul Atreides taking this test that will determine.
Oh, John, hold on a second. If you can hear me, make sure your mic is right up against your mouth.
The first thing you've seen in this novel is Paul taking the test. Of course, the test here is to see if he is the Kwisatz Haderach. But
the Messiah, the basically?
Super being, the one who shortens the way.
Right.
But those tests had that kind of terrible importance for aspiring kids in the Bay Area at that time. I mean, there's a Philip K. Dick novel, one of his lesser known ones called Our Friends from Frolic's Eight. And it also begins with a kid taking the test that will determine whether he's ever going to amount to anything in life, to the point that the father has to go off to a drug bar and take some serious drugs just to calm him down while his kid takes the test. And in that novel, the injustice of these tests is so great that the only way Philip K. Dick can figure out to solve it is to have the aliens come in from Frolix 8, this distant planet, and wipe out all high intelligence, extrasensory perception abilities in the world, so that everybody gets to be stupid. And that's that anxiety about the test comes in other Philip K. Dick stories too. There's one which is usually interpreted as an anti-abortion story, to the point that Joanna Russ, this other science fiction writer, wrote him saying she was going to punch him in the face if she ever met him, in which Philip K. Dick has his this new world in which you can be retroactively aborted at age 11 if you can't do higher mathematics by that time, which in which case I would not be talking to you right now, or unless this was one of those seances, because I couldn't even do higher mathematics when I was in high school. It was just that the rest of my class was totally stoned. That's the only reason I got into Berkeley. The competition was not anything like it was. And there's a whole series of tests in Dune. You know, when he first has to ride the worm, above all, when he takes the water of life, which no male has ever taken and lived. Mm-hmm. There's all this terrible anxiety to be the one, to be the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And that's usually dismissed as laughable. I mean, imagine the way Dune mythologizes those tests that everybody went through in the Bay Area, and compare that to what John Updike or Norman Mailer would do with them. And you begin to see that the prejudice for high literature is actually a rather boring old habit. I mean, what they would
and
do...
And a distraction from what we actually experience.
Yeah. Everybody would be bad. Everything would fail. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm not the most cheerful writer myself, so I should talk, but... That it would always be that, you know, the kid is a loser, the kid is a fool, the whole thing is a farce. And one of the reasons science fiction was able to do such amazing things is that it didn't buy into that downspin on everything. Mm-hmm. There, I mean, and that's where the appeal of jihad comes in. I mean, you want to be the Messiah, and I speak from memories of my own, you know, 15-year-old self. Paul, the protagonist, is 15 when the novel begins. But you don't exactly want to be Jesus, because Jesus is a pretty sad Messiah. You know, you want to be someone from...
He's a scold, too. I mean, that's the thing about it. He's like the Glenn Greenwald of you know, Roman times. He's just going around scolding everyone. It really makes you feel like shit.
You want to be the Messiah, but you also want to be Alexander the Great.
Yes.
You also want to be Einstein.
Yeah.
And you also want to be Shakespeare. And it turns out, lo and behold, that Paul is all those things. He is a mentat, because one of the classes of character in Dune is the mentat, the human computer. This is another really interesting thing that I noticed when rereading Dune just now. In 1965, when computers were just garbage, when there wasn't a computer that could tie its own shoes, everybody was terrified of computers.
Yes.
And as computers got better and better, people got less scared of them and, if anything, kind of bored with them.
Actually, no. Now they think computers are the radical anti-corporate, anti-machine. I mean, it's crazy. But I think, you know, if you delve into that, it's... I've read a good book or two on this. I wish I could remember, God damn it, who wrote them. But, you know, I mean, Silicon Valley has a shit ton of money. And whenever there's money, there's always, some spokesperson, somebody there to talk about how great it is and how radical it is and how it's transforming our lives and empowering us and blah, blah, blah. It's like the railroads had these kind of proselytizers too. These are secular proselytizers for how, and so I think that's part of what happened. But you're right. I mean, in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, computers were seen as sort of the ultimate Orwellian, terrifying, frightening thing that would subjugate us. Yeah.
And what's odd about that is that I remember what computers were then. There were these room-sized things that had to be fed like a foot high of punch cards before they could even do simple calculations. Yeah. It was bizarre being scared of something like that. It's incredible.
Hal.
Yeah, Hal, that's right. Yeah. Hal. He would talk to you in a flat voice and bore you to death. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. So the supposedly in Dune, the computers have been done away with because of something called the Butlerian Jihad. And that's where we get into religion, which is another major element of Dune. I mean, obviously the religion that Dune borrowed most presciently was Islam, but there's also, Herbert was one of these Americans who thought he knew Irish culture, so he invents something called the Orange Catholic Bible, because Orange Catholic, it's an oxymoron.
Yes, very oxymoronic. It's like the Nazi Jewish Bible, Nazi Jewish Torah. You know,
he's full of these oxymorons. He has one cult that he calls Buddhist-Islamic, as in, you know, Buddhist uh-huh. and Islamic jammed together literally as a word, and then Zen Sunni. I've been in Sunni countries. It's not very Zen. Sort of anti-Zen. But
is this because nobody knew any of this stuff? And so, because, yeah. you know, and you have to come up with neologisms, and not everybody can be Tolkien. So he just sort of lopped them together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of things Tolkien can do that Herbert can't do. It's a great novel, but there are some things he can't do. Like, he has bits of, so-called poetry in here, and so-called song lyrics. And I have a sensitive ear. I mean, it hurts. It really hurts. But he did see some things clearly. He saw what a young male imagination is like. And in a sense, there's a dishonesty to the high literature of the era, because it denied all that. Mm-hmm. And yet, I'm sure even, I don't know about Updike, he was too dead, but I'm sure even a young Norman Mailer had dreams like that. Nobody learns to box unless they have dreams like that.
Yeah. What little Mailer I've read, I mean, a lot of it is just absolutely, it's boring, among other things, and insufferable macho shit. But I think, I seem to remember reading about the Pentagon protests, and I think Lomonov may have borrowed a bit from that. You always misread something from another culture. I think he kind of must have misread Mailer, but it was the, you know, it was sort of like Norman Baby goes to the Pentagon protest. But he writes it in that third person, first person, you know, like Lomonov does with Pedro Suksavienko.
That makes sense. So the high literature officially denied all these things and got reduced to a sort of resentful babble. But and the formulaic science fiction writers were embracing it, and that can also lead to absurdity. Like, okay, yeah, it's absurd to want to be the messiah, the super being whose voice is a killing word, and that is what Paul becomes. But it allows you some room, and you can imagine possibilities and recombine the culture in ways that a stricter realist literature couldn't do. So he brought all this in, and he guessed really well about a lot of stuff. I mean, ecology as a term, I can assure you, was not common in 1965, but the planetary ecologist is a major character in Dune. And the Arabic culture was seen as just one of many cultures. East Asia was perhaps considered a much more important culture in 1965. The Middle East was not that important, because the U.S. still had its own oil, if you come down to it. That's probably why.
Right.
So nobody much cared. And I remember distinctly the feeling that this was all part of the old world that would slowly fade away and become modern. I mean, you look back at pictures of the Middle East, from photos of the Middle East from 1965, and it looks like a place that's trying to be modern. And it's not anymore. It decided, we want to dream in a way more like Dune. We want a warrior religion. We want a different path. And he got that right. And nobody else was doing that, because they were busy talking about, you know, couples getting divorced on Cape Cod. And bitter truth is, that isn't where the world was happening. Whatever was going on in Cape Cod didn't and doesn't matter very much. In a way, science fiction became like a way to get yourself out of the first world and into a more fermenting third world kind of place where development is still possible, where growth is still possible. And the simple trope for that is adolescence, you know, and whether you get it from Paul Muad'Dib becoming the Messiah in Dune or you know, some anime like Akira where the kid becomes the size of Tokyo and blows the whole place to bits. It's always, it embraces that idea of growth, of becoming. And he was allowed to do this because although Herbert had pretty limited travel, he was best friends with Jack Vance, who's a hero of mine and a writer who should be better known. And Vance went everywhere. Vance went to Mali. Hmm. You know, nobody had ever been to Mali in 1965, but Vance and his wife went there, and they got as far as Bamako, where you really wouldn't want to go today, and had to come back because they ran out of money. And they saw things that were not the first world. Mm-hmm. And they were, and Vance, I'm sure, told his buddy Herbert about what he saw in Mali, because he and Herbert shared a houseboat on the Delta, believe it or not. Mm. They used to spend summers up on the Delta doing this. And there's a sense in Dune that he borrowed some Arabic grammar, too, to go with the jihad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did 5 quarters of Arabic at Berkeley and learned very little, next to nothing. But,
me too.
Yeah, I remember the Idafa clause, which is how Arabic does genitive. It's sort of like Russian. You do it with case endings, not prepositions. And Dune is full of these real Arabic terms like kitab for book and the blank al blank, you know, the bab al manda or something like that. That's an idafa. It means, so if you say kitab al talib, it means book the student, but it actually means the student's book. And you get all kinds of constructions like that in Dune, and they're the subject of this wonderful blog wars between my people. You know, if anybody is my people, it's these science fiction pedants who are, and there's, I found this blog when I was looking at this called Harry Ticks of Dune blog.
you said that to me, that was amazing. So but first of all, what did he mean by Harry Ticks of Dune? So I don't remember the book well enough. I don't know, was it from that or is it just
I don't remember any Harry Ticks in Dune,
good.
But the slogan of the blog is "There's only room enough in this still suit for one of us," and the still suit is what the, you know, these people on a waterless planet use to save their water. But he's looking into the etymology of Gom Jabbar, which is one of those phrases that's meant to sound Arabic. I don't think it's real Arabic, as far as I know. And I'm just going to read a paragraph from this blog.
Sure.
Just to get the tone of the true science fiction fan. This guy is in a permanent war with Frank Herbert Ayers over who knows Dune better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that too is a classic science fiction fan thing. Like, we don't play around being coy. You know, you go to a high literature conference and people talk about the books that they might or might not love with disdain.
Yeah.
Science fiction fans don't do this. We love this stuff and we're going to kill for it.
Yeah.
So, goes the etymology of Gom Jabbar part 2. Last Saturday I blogged about how stupid Dune Novels blog on Twitter looked, simply reposting Khalid Bahaeddin's partial explanation of the original Arabic source for Gom Jabbar. He explains Jabbar but not Gom. I offered some speculation of my own onto the origins of the mystery word and concluded that until someone comes forward with something definitive from Herbert's notes, one guess is as good as another. Well, we no longer have to wait for the gormless and gomless Herbert Ayers to do the right thing and start
publishing. Ooh, body blows.
So it's almost like comic book guy from The Simpsons on speed. And that's the true science fiction fan tone. And because these books are not coy, you know. The science fiction novels are never coy in that. Well, the good ones are never coy. They're later developed a sort of smirky stuff, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and stuff. But the true science fiction novel, they may be funny, but they're not coy at all. And they have these embarrassing dreams. But, you know, as you said, when you read somebody like Mailer, it's full of embarrassing dreams, too. It's just mm-hmm. that his dreams of being a tough guy are just embarrassing without allowing him to discover anything new or interesting. Mm-hmm. Whereas the embarrassing dreams of being the Messiah in Dune led to a lot of really good guesses. I mean, such as the comeback of jihad. The Fremen in Dune, obviously derived from free men,
mm-hmm.
Are Bedouin, basically. They call mm-hmm. themselves the Ikhwan Bedouin, like Bedouin, like the Bedouin Brotherhood. And they fight very much like people out of Lawrence of Arabia. He may have gotten some of this from Lawrence of Arabia as well.
Well, I was going to say, Freeman, I always wondered, so there was the far right-wing magazine, kind of proto-libertarian from the 40s and 50s and maybe beyond, 60s, 70s, called The Freeman. And there were, I remember studying, you know, some of the right, and they overlap with the sort of early libertarians. I mean, there were these sort of right-wing vigilante groups like the Minutemen, for example. They keep reappearing in different guise. They're usually called either the Minutemen or the Freemen. But they often are, and this goes back like at least, I think, to the 30s. Whenever they pop up, they're these kind of regional right-wing vigilante patriot groups, you know.
Yeah, it's got some of that going. But the interesting thing here is that they're not Americans. I mean, one thing about science fiction as compared to those high literature novels is that they're not completely obsessed with their own culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are hints in Dune that these people came from Misr, which can mean Egypt, or Uraba, which might mean Arabia, but they're definitely not Americans.
I think the good ones, they usually try and get out of our culture. I mean, that's kind of the difference with Philip Dick. He was actually the most realistic realist, certainly writing about like suburban Bay Area of anybody.
He wrote the best. Yeah, he wouldn't even have to be a science fiction writer. He wrote the best descriptions of California of anybody I know. And then he did these amazing twists with them, which never really violated the spirit of California somehow.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is what I would like to do, and if anybody knows a publisher with a lot of money, tell them to call me. What I would like to do is something called Perky Pat's where I just want to write about the Bay Area in 1965 and how it gets warped and mutated and mythologized in these novels that this incredible galaxy of talent produced in a few years. Because 1965 is also when Philip K. Dick is hitting his greatest years, Jack Vance hitting greatest years. It's extraordinary. And they knew that this was something remarkable. And that's something you also see in Hunter S. Thompson, that sense that the Bay Area circa 1965 was a place to be remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And the wretched Martian colonists in Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, which may well be the best science fiction novel ever written, when they take their drugs to dream about their perfect world, what they dream of is driving a convertible around Knob Hill in 1965 with Perky Pat. Or going to Ocean Beach with Perky Pat. It's as if they knew that this part of the world they inhabited, which was very isolated from the rest of America at that time, much more so than now, was something special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, part of it may be that they weren't looking over their shoulders to what the New Yorker audience was thinking of them and expecting of them, that they had opted out of that. And so suddenly that just opened up a whole world of possibilities in terms of just the imagination could kind of go free without wondering, am I being foolish? Am I being, you know, silly and all these other things that these desiccated, talentless fucks and, you know, like Updike. I mean, that's all they're thinking of is their audience, I assume, when they write.
And what they always end up talking about is what they did, which is drugs plus mental discipline. And in Dune, the mental discipline is this sort of Jesuit-like order, the Bene Gesserit and the Mentats, who have become human computers also with the aid of drugs. But what actually happened is they were formulaic writers writing in a despised genre, which everybody else saw as formulaic in a bad way. But because they had learned that formula, because they'd written hundreds of short stories and dozens of novels for a pittance, they had the discipline to take the drugs that were available in the 1960s and use them. And, you know, I know from bitter experience what happens if you take a strong stimulant without proper discipline. You just write gibberish. And when high novelists did so, they wrote horrible imitations of Finnegan's Wake, which is a horrible imitation of something horrible in the first place. But when you have to answer to an audience, to a publisher who wants things to be absolutely clear, and is going to give you a few hundred dollars if you're lucky, you can't afford to do that. Yeah. So they took the drugs and kept their discipline. And in a sense, what they write about as their characters surpass their ordinary humanity is that same phenomenon of drugs plus mental discipline. And among other things, they wrote amazingly good descriptions of war, which I guess is our core subject here. So I'll read one more thing, which is an account of a Fremen ambush of some helicopter-like things. They're called ornithopters. Yeah, nomenclature is not Herbert's strong point. But anyway, he's describing a VBIED, that is a V-born improvised explosive device.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Yeah, it's a what improvised device?
VBIED, like a car bomb.
Oh, I see.
A truck
bomb.
So here's the bit. The troop carrier, this is a huge transport aircraft, settled toward the patch of blue-clad bodies. Its wings crept out to full reach, began the cupping action of quick stop. Hawat's attention was caught by a flash of sun on metal to the south, a thopter plummeting in a power dive, wings folded flat against its sides, its jets a golden flare against the dark, silvered gray of the sky. It plunged like an arrow toward the troop carrier, which was unshielded because of the laser gun activity around it. Straight into the carrier, the diving thopter plunged. A flaming roar shook the basin. Rocks tumbled from the cliff walls all around. A geyser of red-orange shot skyward from the sand where the carrier and its companion thopters had been. Everything there caught in the flame. It was the Fremen who took off in that captured thopter, Hawat thought. He deliberately sacrificed himself to get that carrier. Great mother, what are these Fremen? A reasonable exchange, said one of the Fremen beside Hawat. There must have been 300 men in that carrier. And which is suicide bomber logic, right?
Yes.
You think, how many men, well, how many people, unfortunately, am I going to get versus my life? This seems like it's anticipating contemporary warfare. And in a way it is. But, you know, the materials were always there. I mean, these are people who grew up in the shadow of World War II. And when you talk about a suicide aircraft hitting a carrier, it's pretty obvious that you're harking back kamikazes. But what he's done to put that sort of suicidal drop to kill the enemy into a Middle Eastern guerrilla war on the sand dunes. And that was a darned good guess.
Yeah.
You mix that.
I'm losing you here. I'm losing you here real quickly. Can
okay.
you speak into the mic?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. So what you have with Dune, with any of these great science fiction series, is an aesthetic that's basically hostile to what the mid-late 20th century considered literature. But it was very lucky to be despised, you know, sort of like the way American film was lucky to be despised. I mean, probably what will kill it is the fact that scholars like it now.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to be despised by the people who write articles for the academic journals.
Yeah, so that was also a great point, though. I mean, a kamikaze, probably even still, in general, I mean, it was proof of how utterly barbaric and horrible. At least that's what we were supposed to believe. And we all were told, you know, that it was proof of just how absolutely evil the Japanese were, that they would do these sort of suicide missions into our aircraft carriers. But, you know, you could never help think, it was sort of like that one great moment of Bill Maher right after 9/11 that lost him his ABC gig, when he said, you could say anything about these guys, but cowards is sort of the last thing that comes to mind when you know you're going to die. It's sort of the definition of not cowardly, you know?
Yep, that's true. That was Maher's great moment.
Yeah. And I mean, Herbert, I guess, you know, saw that, I mean, these guys were sort of in touch with their adolescent selves and parts of themselves that just don't need to lie to themselves or lie publicly. I mean, boys especially, they're readers, and young males, you know, find that shit heroic and want a death like that, and have people talk in sort of, you know, glorious language, flowery language like that about their glorious deaths.
Yeah, I mean, the view of life in Dune is not that far from the view of a jihadi. And you got to remember, jihadis skew extremely young, extremely young and mostly male. Mm-hmm. It's people settle into a more Updike or Mailerish life by the time they're 30 as a rule, and accept that any higher life is only for a few mythical figures. But there is that time when you still believe that you live in an epic world. And science fiction put people in that epic world. It's not always a epic in the simple way that Dune is. I mean, Philip K. Dick's world is, there's plenty of day-to-day horribleness in it. It's a more adult world, but there's always something beyond that. It's not just being reminded of the day-to-day horribleness. And I would say there's something epic too, even in Celine's novels, which go about as deep into mundane horribleness as you possibly can, but they go deep enough that it becomes grand.
Yes. Yeah, especially Death on the Installment Plan.
Yeah.
That way. Yeah, I agree. So a couple of things that, and then we'll wrap this up. The first one is, how does Dune read now? Because I'd started to ask you that earlier. I mean, when I read it, and it was a long time ago, I was surprised at how great it was. I read it after I saw the movie Dune, which I think is sort of half great and half awful, which is fine with me.
You don't often get an hour of greatness, and you get an hour of greatness in Lynch's Dune. You also get 90 minutes of ouch, ouch, ouch. But you know, I'll take that, like you said. Yeah. It reads...
And it seemed very Nietzschean to me, too, if I remember right. Like, he was clearly reading Nietzsche. And one other thing that this made me think, especially listening to you, is this kind of explains a bit why Ayn Rand... I mean, you know, there's obviously the big business... people trying to shove all kinds of pro-capitalist writers down everyone's throat. But that doesn't explain why she clicked, why she, you know, does connect and did with all kinds of, you know, 13 to 16-year-old Americans and gets in under their skin, some of them for life. But there is a bit of the same heroic, you know, protagonist.
It's easy to understand the appeal of Rand. It's just that she's a lousy... ideologue and a lousy writer. The drive to be something more than an ordinary person is not in itself despicable. She just used it in despicable ways.
Right. So back to the question,
how does it still read well?
Like
a lot of science fiction, it doesn't read well sentence by sentence, but it made me, that's one reason the older I get, the more I realize sentence schmentens, you know. If you want to write a good sentence, be James Joyce and go choke on it. The sentences are mostly not very good, but the story builds very well, and if you get very far in it, you're going to finish it. The bad parts are the little furniture with which he decorates the beginnings of chapters. Like there's a quotation from the hagiographies of the hero, you know, after he's become God Emperor right. of the universe. And those are kind of boring. When it comes lore, the sense of creating a deep past and a dense past mm-hmm. of borrowing from layers and layers of history is really important to writing good science fiction. Mm-hmm. And he does it fairly well sometimes. He can't write poetry for one thing, and there are a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of attempts at poetry in here, and they're really painful.
I feel like getting back in touch with my, you know, adolescent self. The yeah. descriptions of furniture, as you describe it, and Lauren, the poetry, you would sort of read that and think, oh, I'm reading a book that actually is more serious than just the war, you know, the war porn parts that I really like. And so this is making me smarter, and this guy is smarter. You know, I mean, it,
yep.
there's a certain formulaic purpose to that.
Yep. And it builds pretty well, I have to say. That what I remember about reading novels like this when I was 10, and I was 10 when this came out, though I didn't read it until a few years later, is that most of the time they create in you a deep feeling of, well, I was a depressed kid, so a sense of the impossibility, because everyone seemed to be 7 feet tall, speak 17 languages, mm-hmm. and be able to kill with a single blow. And actually, that is pretty much the description of everybody in Dune. You know, mm-hmm. everybody in the novel is almost a super being in some way or other. Mm-hmm. And that's what you crave. That's what you dream most when you're the original reader, what we would call, let's say, the intended reader mm-hmm. of that novel. You want to be the equal of those people. I mean, in my case, it mostly consisted of comparing myself to them to my own great disadvantage in every single scene.
Well, if you would have gone and just read some Updike, you would have felt better about yourself. Maybe, you know.
And I did, and I did not feel better.
I know.
God, how can anybody read this? I don't care if they do get divorced. I don't care if they do have an affair. Why don't they just die?
I don't care about his fucking cocktail in fucking yeah. Nantucket. I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so the other question I was going to ask is, how does it compare to the David Lynch movie? I guess you kind of answered that already. I don't know.
No, that's very interesting. That's actually very interesting. I was surprised by that when I reread this. The best parts in Lynch's movie involve the guild, you know, mm-hmm. the third stage navigator of the guild. Mm-hmm. The entrance of that third stage navigator is one of the most glorious oh, yeah. anywhere, like we have just folded space from yes. Eeks while that big breathing noise is going
yeah
and the scared emperor going, oh, how was your journey? And the guy just goes on, many machines on Eeks, new machines better than on Rigel. Oh. And that sense of terror and otherworldliness is beautiful.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that in the novel, really. The guild appears late in the novel. It's always mentioned, but they don't appear as characters in the novel at all, and they're by far the best characters in the movies. And then there's the Baron.
Yes.
The other thing that Lynch does beautifully is Baron Harkonnen.
Yeah.
And his Baron Harkonnen, I have to say, is better than the Baron in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Baron That's Harkonnen, how I remembered it, too, yeah.
Yeah. The Baron in the novel, to be honest, he's gay, and there's a lot of homophobic stuff, which was pretty standard for 1965. But he's not as incredibly horrible as the Baron in the film. Lynch invented those scars and pustules all over him. I suppose because they're very cinematic, but they really work.
Yes.
You know, when that horrible doctor is saying, your diseases, yes. love to me.
Yes.
There's nothing of that in the book. He's just as Alia of the Knife describes him towards the end, a frightened old fat man. he's evil, but in an ordinary way. So those are the two parts of the book that were just suggestions to Lynch, and that he did way better. Mm-hmm. As for his Paul is horrible.
Yes,
Kyle MacLachlan is not Paul. He looks like a figure on a wedding cake.
Yeah,
and what you need is someone who can look like an aristocrat who goes feral. And there's no such thing as a feral Kyle MacLachlan. it's an absurd idea.
I'm trying to think who would who would have been a better cast in that role.
Someone sort of sharp faced.
Yeah.
Who was married to Uma Thurman for a while. He has that look of a preppy who would order your death easily.
Oh, Ethan Hawke or one of those types. That does sound better. Oh, so if I remember right, the story behind it was Dino De Laurentiis, was throwing all this money at the Dune movie. Maybe there was even a different director at first, and it wasn't working out. And so he cut a deal with David Lynch that he would finance what Lynch really wanted to do, which was Blue Velvet, which had Kyle MacLachlan. And Kyle MacLachlan was actually perfect for that role.
He was perfect. Yep.
Yeah. And in return, Lynch would do Dune, which he was kind of ambivalent about, and then he started to Lynchize it, in a big way.
Right.
I think that was kind of the story. So that would explain why Kyle MacLachlan was brought in, miscast.
Well, that's another problem with the movie, the Fremen. I think those were probably De Laurentiis Fremen extras because they're awful.
They're really awful, I know.
They look about as scary as an insurance office.
or like a Little League coaches or something like that.
Yeah.
That really didn't work out well. So, so in any event, though, the book is definitely, if you haven't read the book, I would still say definitely worth reading.
Absolutely.
It's relevant, and the movie is definitely great. And I would recommend best if you can watch the movie on some kind of opioid and stay away from my mother's. Stay the fuck away.
I know,
away
there's
from
gonna, there's gonna be a traffic jam outside of the house.
My poor mom is gonna call up, what are all these people doing out here? Like trying to crawl through my window. they're all gone, everyone. So just get away. Nothing to see. Okay, that's it then. I think it worked out. It seems that, we found a way. Thank you to McDonald's in Budapest. Thank you to
Ronald. Turns out the best place to do these things is in McDonald's in Budapest.
Yeah, and all these people badmouth McDonald's, you're McDonald's, you Americans. You know what? It's got Wi-Fi. It made the war nerd. And I hope they fucking pay us for this, for this free advertising. But anyway, I think this worked, and we'll see how it sounds to everybody. And thanks again, and I hope that that we can work something out where it's a little easier for you next time too.
Yeah. It's been a rough few days, but we did it.
And we did.
Thanks,
okay.
Mark, for your patience, and to all our listeners. Sorry for the technical difficulties.
All right. So till next week, because we are weekly now.
All right.
All right.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.